Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, it's Monday in the afternoon, and I want to pick up on what I was talking about, the Herzl series. I'm actually thinking about doing this as a lecture series here in Baltimore, if I can find the sponsors. This is a drive. I didn't have so much luck with the sponsors this week. And then Baruch Hashem, good old Chaim Chernoff showed up, and he's sponsoring it today. He's the guy that put me into this podcast stuff in the first place. And I did earlier today, he put up an advertisement for of ours. And so Chaim's really a person I have to be very grateful for. And now, as I said before, all this business with the war and the campus riots and all the rest of it made me think, the extreme anti-Zionism, not from a Frum point of view, right, from an Arab point of view, you know, so the heck with them. And that, on the other hand, most people, certainly most Frum Jews, I was at my grandson's bar mitzvah the other day, and X number of yeshiva guys, kollel guys, came asking, he said, what exactly is Zionism and all the rest of it, you know? So, anyway, to pick up from where we left off last time, I was talking about Herzl, who again had no, let's put it this way, until he started thinking about the anti-Semitism that I spoke about the other days and the problematic nature of it and the fact it won't go away and what do you do about it. Until then, I mean, I don't think he thought about Judaism b'chlal. I mean, you always do, you know what I mean? Even if you say you don't, you do. And certainly he had no connections or probably acquaintance even with any Shomer Shabbos Jew, right? That's the kind of life he lived. Zero. He couldn't read Hebrew, wasn't interested in reading Hebrew. But like some Jews, he's interested in anti-Semitism. There are people like that today. They have no shaykhus to Torah mitzvahs, but, you know, they're into the Anti-Defamation League and all that kind of stuff, which is, you know, at least that's something Jewish. And nowadays, that's a real plus, as opposed to these people who are marching for Hamas. You understand? Biden gave an interesting speech. I saw a piece of it. But I'll save that for another podcast. Anyway, in that regard. So speaking about Theodor Herzl, one thing led to another. And all these observations about the unending nature of anti-Semitism and the fact that he knew the Geisha mentality better than, I would say, 99% of Jews, because he interacted with them. He didn't interact with Jews so much. Led him, as I said the other day, to try to say, okay, let's make a Jewish state. And he wrote a pamphlet called the Judenstaat, the State of the Jews, in which he basically said the idea that the only way to end the anti-Semitism is if the Jews get their own country. Easier said than done. But then, obviously, if the country be Jewish, then you can't be anti-Semitic. You know, I mean, you won't discriminate anybody on the basis of the fact that they're Jewish. Now, as you and I know, you can discriminate in the fact that they're on the basis of the fact that they're Sephardim or Galicianers or, you know, Hungarian, you know, whatever division you want to make among the Jews. We're very good at that, unfortunately. But it won't be because somebody's Jewish. Okay? Now, I'll say it again. He wasn't the first guy to think this up. But he wrote this up, and he wasn't aware that anybody else thought this way. And since he wrote in German, and he was a journalist, again, he was like an op-ed writer for the biggest newspaper. So you know that, right? And he put together this idea of a Jewish state. This is 1895. Now, I told you, he went to the Richie Riches, and said, why don't you just buy the country? And they turned him down. Because naturally, rich people's like this. It's easy for you to make a suggestion how I should spend my money. Right? Now, this was a failure of vision on the part of the Jewish billionaires, but it happened. I don't know what would happen had they agreed, but it would have been interesting. You could write a novel imagining that. And he also went, I told you, to Hasidic rabbis And he said, you just tell all your followers to move to Israel, to the new Jewish state. We'll have an instant majority. And the Rebbe said, you're nuts. You're nuts. After all, he had no shaykhus Yiddishkeit, which is true, right? I understand where they're coming from. So he did not give up. That's what makes him unusual, right? He said, I have to do it the old-fashioned way, which is to start a political movement and agitate for it legally, legitimately, with the legislatures, with the governments. In other words, there's nothing we're doing, he said, and he was right, nothing we're doing, which is like breaking the law or anything like that. We do have our right to request. Can't demand, but you can request from the Ummah Olam, give us our country back or give us something. Give us Epis something. Now, you can say no. You understand what I'm saying? You can say no. And the only thing I can do is appeal. But at least make the appeal. That's the way he thought. Right? He didn't think about a big Jewish army and coming and conquering and this and that and the other and it's a whole blah. He said, listen, we can go and ask. You know the old line, if you don't buy a ticket, don't expect to win the game. The lottery. At least you can ask. Do the basic gestaltless. This is where it came. And so as a result of being turned down by the Richies and by the Rebbes, he said, I'm going to start my own movement. Because I told you, he was very self-assured and he was arrogant. But sometimes that's a good thing. And he was what's the right word? You know, it wasn't a megalomaniac, nothing like that. But, well, actually, I don't know. A little bit he was. But, But, he had a chutzpah. But not in a dumb way. Because he didn't say go and scream and this, that, and the other. He said, let's turn this into something real. And he put out a cold Corey, I guess you'd say, to other Jews around the world, mainly in Europe, of course. People who were turned on to his idea, because once he wrote this and published this pamphlet, some people say you're crazy. But you know how it goes. Anybody's in the Kiruv business knows. Ask Lubavitcher. You talk to 10 people, 9 say you're nuts, and the 10th guy becomes from. That means if you talk to 100 people, 90 will say you're crazy, and 10 will become from. You know, that's how it goes. So he put the idea out there and he articulated it. And a lot of people, most Jews, said you're nuts. Like, who the heck is this guy? I'll talk more about that later if I remember. But some Yechidim said it's a good idea. And so there were people in Germany, there were people in Austria-Hungary and Empire. There were certainly people in the Russian Empire, which included Poland and Belarus, Ukraine, and all the rest of it. There were a few people, in Western Europe, you know, France, England, Holland, and all the rest of it. And his idea was to make a splash, a PR splash. His godless was in PR. That's who he was. If there's one field he knew better than anybody else, today you call him a communications consultant or something like that, PR consultant. Because he was in the newspaper business, you know, and he understood what sells and what doesn't sell and all the rest of it. And that is a tremendous thing. Because if you know how to manage the PR, you can make me'atim into rabim, so to speak. You can make a small idea into a big one, and you can be taken seriously, and that's what he wanted. So he said, let's have let's have a movement to establish a Jewish state. Well, they didn't say it clearly, but that's where it was going. He wanted to hold a... Now, in those days, like nowadays, you have to have a convention, or a congress, as they call in Europe. They go to convention, right? It's a Mizrahi convention. It's a this convention, that convention. Again, in Europe, they call it a congress. And that's where everybody gets together, and either they do stuff or they make speeches, blah, blah, blah. There's plenty of that. And sometimes they actually get things done. So he said, let's make a congress or a convention for representatives from all the different countries. And let's meet somewhere in Germany. That's where they used to have all the conventions. And discuss the situation. And if you agree with me, which he was confident that they would, we'll call for a revival of Judaism in its own country. In other words, we should get a state of Israel. Not using those words, of course. Now, the interesting thing is, first of all, in Germany, there was tremendous opposition. And the reason is because there were several schools, as we shall see, of thought and opposition, bitter opposition to Zionism, from different points of view, right? So like I said before, he had to have a lot of confidence and chutzpah and not give a darn what somebody else says. Not everybody's built that way, but he was. And there were a lot of different Jewish groups out there, Hamunan, that were against this and thought he's crazy for totally different reasons. For example, I'll tell you about totally different reasons. The Reform movement and Jews like that in Western European countries were shocked and horrified that a guy should say the Jews have their own country. Why? Because here, it's the 1890s, they recently got their civil rights from the different European countries. In this year or in that year, over the course of the 1800s, it was with the unspoken assumption that the Jews will be members of that country, they'll be super patriotic. So if you're a German Jew, you're going to be a super German patriot. And a French Jew, you're going to be a French patriot. An English Jew, English patriot, and so forth. Which means, basically, I'm talking about the Reform now. And people like the Reform, you know, conservative, whatever you liberal, they called it. So they have already, by 1890, bought into the idea, which makes them very comfortable, that Judaism has nothing to do with being a nation. It's strictly religion. So the analogy of Judaism is not a Jew versus an Englishman or a Frenchman. The analogy is a Jew versus a Catholic or a Protestant or a Muslim or something like that. It's a religious business. Why? Because the whole argument of the liberal Jews was to the Goyim was give us complete citizenship and equal rights. So let us do what we want. But in return, we'll show that we earn it because we'll be loyal members of the country, super loyal actually, and there'll be no minus, it'll all be a plus. You get a bunch of Jewish citizens, they'll fight for the country, of course they'll obey the laws of the country. Not only that, they'll become culturally members of the country. This was the biggest problem in the 1800s and the 1900s, that people wanted to mamish assimilate and drop the Jewish stuff and leave at the most a minimal feeling. You know, once a week you go to temple or something like that. Maybe. But your Iker identity is I'm a Frenchman, I'm Italian, I'm a German. I think most listeners of the podcast here have probably heard the stories about the German Jews, how super patriotic they were. All right, said. But the Hungarian Jews was the same thing. And by the way, the Orthodox were part of this. Very few of the Orthodox. I'm talking about people who are Shomer Torah mitzvahs, medaktik mitzvahs, and all that sort of thing. Most of them, I won't say most, but many, there's no way I know. But so many of them said like this, I'm a German, and this is the best country in the world, and the Kaiser is Gewaltig. I'm also, religiously, by religion, a Jew, and therefore I'm Shomer Torah mitzvahs. You see what I'm saying? So their identity was not that of a Jew. The identity was that of a German who has the Jewish religion. Which in the case I'm talking about, they would interpret to say the Jewish religion in the halachic sense, meaning we keep the Torah and the mitzvahs, which is admirable. I'm not knocking it. But really, 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 this is a kind of a sin because a person's not supposed to say that. So say I'm primarily a Jew. I'm loyal to the country. I keep the laws. If I can benefit the country, I do. And many of the German Jews benefited Germany. You know, in other words, there's no minus for you guys. But in the 1800s, you couldn't say that. Now, for those of you who listening here in America and or lived in America, this is a hard thing to understand because the United States had a different experience in the 1800s. It just had a different experience. In this country, no pressure was put on you to Americanize by the society. It was just happened anyway. Happened in Mela. You understand? So you could be as, if you wish to, you could be as from as you want and identify as a Jew as much as you want. As long as you have your citizenship, you keep the laws, you pay the taxes and so forth and so forth. This is a free country. Europe was somewhat different. There was a freedom, but it was like an unspoken Tanai. And Tanai is you will identify and mean it with the native people. So then you're talking about a certain Shevet. I'm a German. That means I belong to the Shevet of Germany. I'm just an Orthodox Jew. Well, you don't belong to the Shevet of Germany, see? And when Hitler came along, they proved it. And same thing in the other countries. So this kind of split personality that I just described, Ma'adoch, if this is true about an Orthodox Jew, whose mamash ha-shomer Torah mitzvah medaktik b'mitzvahs, which they were, then how much more so for a conservative, reform, secular, all the rest of it? How much of their identity was Jewish? You understand? It's a sad business. And Herzl saw this. It's one of the reasons, not the only reason, one of the reasons he said, we want our own country, we shouldn't simply disappear, among others. Now, perhaps it was a little easier for him to do because he lived in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which had like 50 different nationalities. So many have written about this. And so a person couldn't say, you know, I'm ethnically an Austrian or something like that. Because he got the Austrians, the Czechs, the Slovaks, the Hungarians, the Romanians, the Croatians, Slovenians, this, that, and the other. He really did. And many more. So, you know, you could say I'm a citizen of the Austrian Empire, but primarily identify as a Jew. That's a whole schmooze by itself. And by the way, in Hungary, where he grew up, in Hungary, during the period I'm talking about before the First World War, was Kaiser Franz Josef. Let me tell you something. The firmest of the firm, with some exceptions, the firmest of the firm, Mamish said, I guess we are Hungarian patriots. They were more patriotic than the German Jews were patriotic to Germany. I think I told you once, you know, in that firm school in Vienna, Stumpfergasse, which was a Hungarian shul. So it was a Orthodox Shomer Shabbos synagogue, not the big ship shul. It was a branch of it. And I did this once with the Hood Rabbi Flesh. And so in other words, it was Mamasha Shomer Torah Mitzvah synagogue. And it wasn't so easy to be that way. But they insisted that the shul should put all of its savings, his bank account, in Hungarian bonds to show how patriotic they are. You see? This is how it was. I could go on and on about this. In the back of my mind, I'm thinking of doing a series on the Hungarian Jews, especially in World War II. So many of them could not believe that Hungary would, you know, give them over to Hitler and so forth. It's a very interesting story. What's her name? Professor, you know, from lady, Esther Farbstein. She came out with a book on this. In English. I really have to thank Chaim Mayer for that. He sent it to me. The bottom line is that those type of Jews, if somebody comes up and says like this, no, your homeland is Eretz Yisrael. We don't have a homeland yet, but let's strive to get one from the Goyim. And then you'll be a Jew living in a Jewish state, the same way a Frenchman is living in a French state, and Italians living in an Italian state. Meaning, you're saying Judaism is a funny thing. It is a religion, but it's more than a religion. It's also a nation, which is true, right? It is. It's not a regular type nation, you know what I mean? But it has those aspects also. This has always been something that bothered Western researchers and scholars, thinking like, what exactly is Judaism? Especially in the 19th and early 20th century. There are like so many articles and things on this kind of business. And this one tries to prove this. So I'll say it again. To a classic Reformed Jew of the old school, Judaism is not a nationality. Maybe it was once long ago when the Jews were stupid, but now Judaism is just a religion. And the same way my next door neighbor is a Christian, is a Catholic or a Protestant, but he's a German or French, whatever it is. I'm also a German or Frenchman, but my religion happens to be Judaism. They go to church on Sunday. I go to synagogue on Saturday if they did that. You see, that's the only difference. And here comes this guy Herzl and says, hope I didn't say anything. They didn't like that. They will totally confirm what the Goyim say. The Germans are saying we shouldn't get any citizenship because we're not really loyal to Germany. The French say we shouldn't get any citizenship here because we're not really loyal to France. You know, this is why the Reform cut out from the davening anything nationalistic. All that stuff. Because otherwise, a German could say, I guess, why do you want civil rights in Germany? You yourself, in your own prayers, admit you want to go back to Eretz Yisrael. So the Germans say, no, we don't. We cut that out. We don't want to go back to Eretz Yisrael. You see? And here comes a guy, and you can't say he's a frummy, the opposite. And he's saying, listen, we're a separate group, and that's it. Get over it. Get over it. And because it is, there was a tremendous opposition to Zionism when it started from those kind of people. And they had so much power in Germany that it was impossible for him to make a convention there. You see? Now, it's a little strange, because I'll tell you again, the Orthodox, some of the, I have to be careful here. Let me put it this way. What I just said about Ringo, real German, and all Jew by religion, that is not, for example, Samson Raphael Hirsch. It's not. He said, I'm a Jew. I'm a loyal citizen of my country. I'm a Jew. You see? He was like that. But there were a fair number of even Orthodox rabbis that got so into this that they went along also. So it's just interesting to me. He had a public, what do you call it? Public letter was written by a bunch of Reform rabbis and an Orthodox rabbi, where they said, we don't have no convention over here because we're Germans. We don't want anything that smells like, you know, a Jewish state sounds like we're not patriotic. How to get an Orthodox guy to write on that? I'm not 100% sure. This was the non-Hirschian Orthodox rabbi in Frankfurt. What was his name? Marcus Horowitz. I think, what was it? Mordechai Horowitz? I forget his Hebrew name. You know, you know what I'm talking about. You must know this. In Frankfurt, Sam Strangler said like this. We have to have a separate Kehilla, Austritt. You leave the regular community because they're not from, and form your own from community. Was parallel institutions. If it's up to Hirsch, you have separate schools, separate synagogues, of course, separate cemeteries even, which was a problem for many, separate JCCs, the whole nine yards, right? That's the Hirschian sheet that I think you know it. And there were others who disagreed with that and said, no, you can be part of the general community as long as you're not obstructed in keeping your own mitzvahs. In other words, the community doesn't act against you. And because they wanted to fight Hirsch, the general community, the non-from, in the 1800s said, you know, we will pay for Orthodox shul and school and all the rest of it. So notice, like you say today, the Federation will fund the from stuff. It's the observant stuff. So that's right, Mordechai Horowitz. I forget, whatever his name was. I know in English it was Marcus Horowitz. I believe he was the son-in-law of the Aruch Lanier. And a big Talmud of Rav Zvi Hildesheimer. He was a Talmud Chacham. But he felt differently on this. So I don't know why, except the fact is... So notice there were two Orthodox shuls in Frankfurt. And his obviously must have been the modern Orthodox. I mean, that's what it has to be. You know, the modern Orthodox. Although he was, I'll say it again, he was a frum guy. I mean, he wasn't like a, you know, Chove or anything like that. Not at all. But... And you know, he had his own yeshiva. I mean, he knew how to learn. And he had shalos and tshuvas. Long, long ago, I had a chance to get one of those, and I let it slip through my fingers. What a mistake. I forget what it's called. Yad HaLevi? Something like that. It's not Yad HaLevi. The name escapes me. Anyway, he signed a letter against Herzl. He said, we don't want anybody to set up a movement over here or have a convention, which will make it seem like we're not good Germans. Do you see what I'm saying? That was the atmosphere. In the end, he moved it to Switzerland. He found in Basel, which is still a firm community today, there was a Hirschian type community already at that time, a small one. And I know Mrs. Eisman's grandfather, I guess. Yeah, he was in a good person later on. Cohn, Rabbi Cohn. Maybe it's Arthur Cohn. I think that might be the name. Was a frum guy, you know. Tamachami. And Herzl contacted him. He said, you can have it here. You know, you can have it here. And so Herzl proceeded to do something very interesting. Unprecedented. As like a game changer. And that is the following. He said, we're going to have a convention of Klal Yisrael, meaning representatives of the Jewish people around the world, to consider and discuss the matzav of Klal Yisrael. He didn't use those words, but that's what it boils down to. And the problems of Klal Yisrael and what we can do about it. You understand? The same way every cause in the world does that. You have a problem, you have a convention or a conference, you get together people, They talk about the idea, because if you don't talk about it, nothing changes, right? If you talk about it, you get together, people from different places, maybe something will change for the better. Maybe. Maybe not, but maybe. That was his attitude. And eventually they picked up the name Zionism. That was from, what's his name, Birnbaum, who later became the Agudah, Nathan Birnbaum, who at that time was not from yet. And he was one of these student leaders in the Jewish fraternities in Vienna, in the universities, of the more Jewish ones. And, you know, he came and he said, we'll call the movement Zionism. Fine. So they had a convention there. And this is the famous story. Herzl showed up, and Rabbi Cohn said, like this, it's on this component, you know. If you come over here, it's going to Jewish thing. You have to go to shul on Shabbos. I think this may be the first time he's ever in shul, or second time, you know, very rarely went to shul. And they gave him an aliyah in Basel. And I told you again, he had to read Baruch Hu, B-O-R-C-H-U, Baruch Hu Hashem, Baruch, you know. He couldn't read Hebrew, right? But so what? You see? Now, what they then did was, they had a meeting, a convention, or as in Europe they called a congress, called the First Zionist Congress, here in Basel, Switzerland, where there wasn't such a big pushback. Because the Jews in Switzerland, they can't say we're Swiss. The Swiss are so racist. You know, it wasn't even Hava mean that someone could say we're part of the Swiss. You know what I mean? You can live here. You understand? You can live here. You can be a citizen, those who are. I think you know, Switzerland already asked the Shechita, like before, in the 1880s or something like that. That's who they are. So, they held a meeting there. Now, Herzl, so there are two points I want to make about this. Nobody ever before then, in the whole Gaulis, ever said, why don't we make a meeting of leaders or representatives of different kilos from around the world to represent Klal Yisrael? All through the Middle Ages and afterwards, and before all, of course, it was every kahila for itself, every medina for itself. That's how the Jews survived. Maybe they were afraid, whatever. The reason is, those in different centuries, it wasn't even in Havamina that you should get, let me put it this way, what was this, I'm just making this up, what was the stop, let's say for example, in the 1500s, have a meeting in Istanbul or someplace like that, of all the big rabbonim from the different medinas, from Poland, from Germany, from Italy, from Eretz Yisrael, and the Sfaradim, and so, you know, and sit there and be metakas etza, how to improve things in Klal Yisrael. There's always a need for improvement in Klal Yisrael, right? This didn't even enter the mind of Rabbi Yosef Karo, the Ramor, or something like that. You don't do that. Why not? You don't do it. And here comes so the Jewish people, as a people, as a nationality, yeah, drifted along. Maybe it was due to the fact they didn't want the Goyim to think the Jews are a threat or something like that. But there are many times, certainly in the earlier 1800s, you could have had a frum thing where it's an international organization representing all different frum communities. That later on, my friends, is what the Agudah was. They tried to imitate the Zionist movement. But here, for the first time ever, Herzl assembled people, some from Germany, some from Austria, some from Hungary, some from Russia, some from Poland, some even from Italy, places like it. There was even one delegate from the United States, the rabbi of the Ekesh Shul, which is now the Glen Avenue Shul, the Sheretz Israel. So rabbi at that time, who's a frum guy? Safer. So he came as the representing American Jewry. Let's put it that way. Now, the thing is that this has never been seen before. It seemed bizarre to many Jews. On the other hand, it kind of caught the imagination. And most importantly, from Herzl's point of view, the Goyim bought it. You see? So what am I talking about? You're making what you call a convention. I'm going to use an American example to make it easy to understand. I'm having a convention, and I'm having delegates from all the 50 states. So from North Carolina, South Carolina, from Illinois, from Ohio, from Montana, from Oregon, California, and so forth. Now, what does that mean, you have a delegate from that state?
in order to be really a delegate, you'd have to have a vote. The people in Oregon voted you to be their representative in some kind of way, which didn't happen. The only time in the U.S. where you have people who are elected as delegates, Mamish elected, you don't even know this, Mamish elected to represent the state and all the rest of it, is the Electoral College. When you, in America, when you vote for the president, you, technically speaking, you do not vote for the president. I mean, you can press the button for Trump or Biden, but what you're really doing is saying, I'm voting for the slate of electors who will go to the Democratic or the Republican convention, depending on who gets the most votes. Not the convention, but the delegates that were selected by the Republican Party or by the Democratic Party. And then, when the what you and I call the regular presidential election is over in America in the first week of November, a month later comes the actual legal vote. But let's say, for example, for argument's sake, let's say Biden wins Maryland. That means he gets more votes in Maryland. So that means that of the two slates of candidates, the set of 10 here and 10 there, or something like that, the one that goes to vote will be, let's say, the Democratic one if Biden won. So they will go to something a month later called the Electoral College in Washington. And there they'll mamish have a vote who should be the next president of the United States. That's how they set up in the 1700s. They've never changed the rules. See, even though we have an appearance that you're voting on election day for the president of the United States, and you kind of are, you know, in realistic terms, but from the legal point of view, it's not true. You understand? But at least, if I talk to some guy, it's probably a yutz and a half, because I saw the names on the election ballot, who's, let's say, for example, committed to Biden or something. In Maryland, you have to be a Democrat to be for the primaries, you know, because everything's run by the Democrats here. You can vote in the general election all you want. You can vote any way you want, but in the primaries, most people are registered Democrats. So I, assuming that, like I say, the Democrats won the majority of the votes in Maryland, so this slate of candidates, let's say 10 people, white, black, orange, green, this, that, and the other, gay, schmay, this, you know, whatever they are, will go to Washington. And if they say like this, who made you the representatives of Maryland? He'll say the voters, which is true. So now it's there, you have a legitimacy from election. Now, I'm going to contrast that with what they call the European system, which was that you used to have these, and in America also, to be honest, you have these causes or conventions or ideas or groups or congresses, and they are pursuing a certain goal, and they claim, I want to emphasize the word claim to represent the people. They weren't voted, there was no elections or anything like that, which of course in America, let's say for example, in a Jewish case, you couldn't have a Jewish election. How can you have a Jewish election? You can't get every, this is a free country, a secular state, you can't get every member of the Jewish community to have a separate vote. I mean, theoretically, you could, voluntarily, but it's not going to happen. So it's not literally possible, realistically, in America, to have, let's say, in Baltimore, from the 100,000 Jews in Baltimore, a Jewish election. Right, so then what happens? What happens? People say like this. So it's not a typical election, but we nevertheless come from Maryland, or from New York, or from Mexico, or from England, and we claim to be representatives in some ways of the Jewish communities in our country. They didn't elect us, and maybe they agree with us, maybe even they don't agree with us, but we know better than them what's good for them. That's the way these movements work. They're good is exactly the same way. You know what I'm saying? We know for them better than they know for them. So it's not a kind of a democracy in the sense that it all depends on the vote. It's a kind of democracy based on a certain elitism. Very common. We know what's better, and therefore, since we know what's better, you know, we're gonna, you know, make, we're gonna have a meeting, a convention. We'll have passed resolutions, and we'll take actions. And we're speaking on behalf of the people where we come from, even though they didn't elect us.
The Communist Party runs that way. The Socialist Party runs that way. The, you know, tons of movements run that way. Okay? Like I said the other day, if you're in favor of abortion, you're against abortion, you're in favor of this, favor of that, against that. So that's what he did. He said, I'm calling together a meeting with people from all over Europe. That's mainly what it was, with a little bit more than that, primarily from all over Europe. And they represent the Jewish masses out there. So if we have people coming from Galicia, which they did, they represent the 300,000 or 400,000 Jews in Galicia. If we have people coming from Lithuania, they represent the 200,000 or whatever number it was of the Jews in Lithuania. If we have people coming from Italy, they represent in some way, you know, the 30,000 Jews in Italy and so forth. Now, is it true? No. I said before, it's a bluff. That's what politics is to a large degree. It's a certain bluff, especially international scene. But never, I mean, like a rabbi from the Glen Avenue Shul in Baltimore, he represents all the Jews in the United States in 1897. There are already like 1 million Jews in America. They never heard of this rabbi, you see? But the idea is we have a delegate from America. And so you had the appearance, I want to emphasize the word, the appearance of a Jewish Congress, of a meeting of representatives of all Klal Yisrael, which had never, ever happened. And they're getting there in open discussion, nothing secret about this, right? In open discussion, covered by the press, okay? He, you know, I keep coming over and over again. He said, this is not a sneaky thing at all. What can we do to help improve the situation of Klal Yisrael? Because it's 1897, and millions of Jews are stuck in the Russian Empire, suffering terrible persecution. There are millions of other Jews outside the Russian Empire and other parts of Europe who are suffering anti-Semitism of one form or another, sometimes more vicious, sometimes less vicious. What is there to do about it? Should the Jews just, you know, continue being kicked around all the time and doing nothing? Or should we try to do something about it? This is what the public discussions were all about. This is what the public discussions were all about. So I'll say again, there's nothing wrong with any of this. If you want to be technical, it's a certain bluff, because like, who appointed you? And believe you me, all the Jews in Europe said, a bunch of bull artists, they're coming presenting themselves as leaders of Klal Yisrael, representatives of Klal Yisrael. They don't represent nothing, baby. You know, they don't represent Jack. It's a bluff. I mean, the Jews in Russia and Poland and Hungary and all the rest of it. Who's this guy Herzl? And he's got the chutzpah to say that he's the leader of the Jews, or he's convening a congress of the Jews, and so on and so forth. So Ruba the Ruba the Ruba, you know, people took it as a bluff. But he was smart, and he said like this. The whole thing is to convince the Goyim. If I convince the Goyim, then the Jews will be impressed. Which is, of course, true. And so he made his business that this is something that's going to get on the front page of the news and be taken seriously. In order to be taken seriously, it has to be very respectable looking. Everybody has to dress in tuxedos and should look distinguished. And it should look like this. The Jewish people are coming together in for the first time in some kind of a congress. And, you know, Europe should pay attention to that. Now, again, I repeat, the Jews said, I guess, what a bull artist. But guess what? It worked. The guy took him seriously. He made sure, remember, he was a PR specialist. He made sure that the convention, the Congress, is held in a big hall, very fancy schmancy. Everything was done in German. Everything was done according to Robert's Rules of Order. You know, they took things seriously. The people who came, for the most part, were educated Jews of one sort or another. And no, it was just a Hasidic convention or something like that that would make a European laugh. You had doctors and lawyers and, you know, people with PhDs and this and that and the other, along with many others. And for whatever reason, the newspapers in Europe said, oh, the Jews are having a big convention, and this is an interesting Zach. It's actually very impressive looking in a certain way. And that means that he achieved his goal that
This just one looked at some crackpot scheme, but it's looked as an actual political idea. Doesn't mean it's going to work. It was a suggestion, all the rest of it, but by no means was it considered something weird or stupid. It was considered unusual that the Jews should want to get their own country and all the rest of it. That part is true. But I'll say it again. See, he's the one who gets the credit for the first time in history since the Jews, since Bais Rishon, even not even Bais Sheni. And maybe, yeah, since Bais Rishon, that at least an attempt was made to give the impression, to give the appearance of a Jewish people, of a Klal Yisrael coming together as such to discuss their own future openly and, unafraid and all that kind of stuff, and come up with a civilized 19th century kind of answer. How do you solve the Jewish problem, as they call it? The Jewish population was growing. I told you it was a baby boom between 1830 and 1930. The Jewish population quintupled. So it's only going to get worse and worse. Meet too many Jews, which of course Hitler later exploited. And so we got to do something. And the question is what? And by the time it's over, after all the speeches and this, that, and the other, they came up, of course, with the Basel program. But I see I've gone a little bit too far in this. So let me pick up this next time. Again, I want to thank Chaim Chernoff for this part of the series. And maybe somebody will step forward for the Chumash or the Parsha. And with that, I bid you all a good day.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidovidkatz.com.